Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Ben and Mace with you. I have to go ahead and apologize initially for any construction noises you might hear. Construction is always going on at Dove Valley, it seems. So while they're finishing up some touches on some new offices and things, you might be able to hear them working in the background.
Yeah, in fact, when Phil Milani and I were out on the practice field Thursday morning recording the mailbag video for this week, there was construction going on out there. The parking lot, the players and coaches parking lot's being torn up and repaved. And also a sidewalk, it looks like, is being constructed between that parking lot and the indoor practice facility, so players aren't always walking on the grass when they go over to the indoor facility on a day-to-day basis. It seems like every year, there's something. Obviously, last year the renovations were pretty extensive, but as I was standing out in the field on Thursday morning, I was thinking to myself how the Vista looks so different compared to, say, 12, 13 years ago. I mean, I've been covering this team long enough to remember when they had the old practice bubble where the strength and conditioning facility is now, and how on the first day of training camp in 2003, a storm hit and literally blew the bubble apart, where the white canvas was flapping in the breeze, and that was the end of that. And that's
Did it disintegrate and go into the air? Or?
Yeah, I mean, like after the storm and after it was ripped, it was just flapping around there for a while, and they actually had to come take it away, obviously, because it was a start of training camp. You had people showing up for training camp, and it was a potential hazard. So yeah. It was an old school turf field on under that bubble. The old AstroTurf felt like a Brillo pad. And its last Broncos use was for 03 minicamp, and then it went away forever. And ever since then, and that was 12 years ago, ever since then, it just seems like there's always been something done in this building, something, some kind of renovation, some kind of tweak to it. And, the result is that it's made it a viable headquarters building for the Broncos for hopefully the next couple of decades. I mean,
just a headquarters for a building, but headquarters for kind of like almost like a campus between the field house and the team store that's up there, and some of the things that they're putting in there.
Yeah, that's the way it's going. I mean, the number of teams that don't have an on-site indoor practice facility now, you can pretty much count on one hand, I believe. It's essential. I mean, it's and not just for, presenting an attractive front when you're wooing free agents and all that, but it's essential just for day-to-day work. I mean, for years, the Broncos had gone down the street to the South Suburban Sports Dome whenever weather prevented them from practicing outside, and it worked. But it was a very well used turf field there, because there's a lot of rec leagues and of soccer, lacrosse, things like that. And frankly, the field a couple of years ago was in pretty poor shape, and may even have contributed to Quentin Carter's knee/hamstring injuries that he when he got hurt during 2013 training, or during 2012 training camp. Pardon me, when he was trying to make a play in the back of the end zone. So, it's good the Broncos have what they have now, but again, it's remarkable how much things have changed around here over the years.
To borrow a NFL cliche, a different type of road graders are in the players' parking lot right now.
Yes.
Actual road graders.
Ironic, because the Broncos' zone-blocking heavy offensive line scheme really doesn't favor road graders anymore.
As we move into our training camp previews that have been rolling out this past week, we started with safeties, and then you moved on to running backs. Running backs have been kind of, I mean, their role in Gary Kubiak's offense has been kind of rotational, in that they've been able to get a lot of great performances out of a lot of great running backs. From, I think you talked about Mike Anderson. Just a lot of these guys, like I think you said Selvin Young. Yeah, Olandis Gary. They've managed to get a lot out of players in those, especially in the 2000s, after Terrell Davis's injury. So it seems like they've been able to do a lot, and they have a lot of options this year between Monte Ball, C.J. Anderson, Capri Bibbs, Ronnie Hillman, Juwan Thompson. I think that pretty much is all the running backs, but they've all managed
to find their
ways.
Did you name Jeremy Stewart?
I did not. Jeremy Stewart as well.
Everyone forgets about Jeremy Stewart just because he was a mid-season pickup last year, but can't count him out either, but it's interesting, some of the older names that I wrote about and that you just mentioned. The one I kind of go back to that is maybe analogous to where the Broncos sit right now is Ruben Drones in 2004. Now, the Broncos went into the 04 camp with a clear number one back, Quentin Griffin, and he had a very big game late in the previous season against Indianapolis when Clinton Portis was hurt. And frankly, his performance late in that season was one of the factors that motivated the Broncos and Mike Shanahan, the head coach at the time, to being willing to make that famous trade for Champ Bailey in the 04 offseason. But they went to 04 training camp, and they had Quentin Griffin. They drafted Tatum Bell. Mike Anderson was at fullback. Ruben Drones was working behind him at fullback. And obviously, like I said, Griffin had the big game in the previous year. But it was not a 100% certainty going into camp who was going to be the number one back. And it turned out Ruben Drones, probably the fourth option in that group because he was working as a second-team fullback, end up exploding that year. Mike Anderson tore his groin in preseason. He was lost for the season. Griffin, had the big costly fumble in week two at Jacksonville and never really seemed to get over that, and then had an ankle injury and then tore his ACL. And Tatum Bell really, couldn't quite get on track that year. And it fell upon Ruben Drones, and even though he didn't become the starter at tailback until October, he ended up, having another 1,000-yard season, being in a link in the chain. Frankly, all those 1,000-yard running backs over those years helps explain why Terrell Davis is still on the outside looking in with the Hall of Fame, because there was the perception for a time that it was the system that made the running back, not the other way around. And so when you had Olandis Gary, Mike Anderson, Clinton Portis, Ruben Drones, and then the year after Gary Kubiak left, Tatum Bell, all getting 1,000-yard seasons in that scheme, it made some people think that Terrell Davis wasn't that good. Well, I think what Terrell Davis did, although the system did help him, he did stuff that no one else in that scheme did. 2,000-yard season. He was a league MVP, he was Super Bowl MVP. Like you said, the only thing he lacked was longevity. But for a time, he was.
Well, I mean, his peak lasted for multiple years. Like he,
4 years.
Yeah.
Well, really 3 years, because the first year as a rookie, he had a good season, but he was not Terrell Davis. But 96 to 98, he was, he was on the rampage. He was the best back.
Exactly. You couldn't say that about any of those other backs, mm-hmm. that they were on the rampage for that long.
He was the best back in football, and that's saying a lot because Barry Sanders was still,
at his
apex. He had the 2,000-yard season of his own in 1997, that Terrell Davis distinguished himself in that era was certainly a major accomplishment. Now, I think as time has gone on, and I think as running back career spans have in general become shorter,
mm-hmm.
it seems like it's become an even higher attrition position than it was. I think that has helped the reevaluation of Terrell Davis's career, and I think at some point Davis is going to get in the Hall of Fame. It's now that he's gotten in the room as a finalist, I think you're going to see him get in at some point. But again, back to the point about this scheme and tying it into this year's running back group. Yes, C.J. Anderson has the inside track, and very similar to the inside track that Quentin Griffin, who also wore number 22, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. Had 11 years ago, doesn't mean he's necessarily going to have the job. And I could see any one of those backs, if they end up having to play extensively, being able to deliver a big performance right on down to Stewart and Capri Bibbs if injuries strike, and or if they have just a lights out summer and they end up getting the call. I could see either of them, especially Capri Bibbs, because I think Bibbs is a real natural fit for this offense. And frankly, from what I saw in OTAs, even though he doesn't have good timed speed, I thought he looked quicker in this scheme than, say, Ronnie Hillman, who has the best timed straight line speed of the group.
Now, you're right about Stewart. We always forget about him as a midseason acquisition. And I was kind of wondering what it is that you've seen from him. In what ways has he really stood out to you?
Well, he's got the experience. I think he's adapted well to the coaching he's getting.
Has he been like
most Stanford guys, he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
So when the coaches tell him, hey, we're going to focus on one cut and go, he knows how to do that. And he has some experience as a kickoff returner in the league, so he does have, you know, he does have some good measurable speed at this level. The issue for him is just the quality in front of him. You know, C.J. Anderson's coming off a Pro Bowl season. Monte Ball, I think, as long as he avoids the kind of injuries that he had, the kind of injury issues he had last year with the groin, and he's, you know, tried to emphasize yoga, Pilates, flexibility type stuff this offseason. So he thinks that's going to help him avoid a season unlike any other in his football career, because he was amazingly durable at Wisconsin despite taking a pounding. It was really the first time he dealt with injuries that kept him out a significant amount of time. You know, he's going to be in the mix. And the thing with him that also you have to note is he's been studying this offense since he was, you know, 8-9 years old, you know, when he was a Bronco fan. So he understands zone, working behind a zone blocking system. He understands, you know, what it means when the running back coach says one cut and go, which is what Studisville is telling the guys now, which is what Bobby Turner used to tell the running backs back in the salad days of the 1990s and 2000s when this running game was working. And then, you know, Ronnie Hillman, it depends how he adapts. I mean, I'm not sure that this is a good scheme fit for him, but if he can be decisive in the way he cuts, he's got a chance certainly with the speed he has to become effective. And then Juwan Thompson, he's another guy I think who's been kind of overlooked, but it's interesting with him because I think we sat here, I know a number of other pundits sat at their spots and said, okay, Juwan Thompson might be a fullback this offseason, but they might convert him.
Yeah.
They didn't do that. I think that says something about how the coaches feel about Juwan Thompson as a running back and saying, hey, don't go add 10, 15 pounds. Just go, you know, be a tailback and do what you do best. And he had some nice runs in OTAs. And we saw last year that even though he's a bigger back, he's got some moves and space as well. And he actually had the Broncos' longest run in over three years with his 47-yard carry against Buffalo last December. So
it always seems like he falls forward too.
Yes,
he always maintains momentum and keeps his feet under him. And I mean that's the thing that C.J. Anderson does well also. But Juwan Thompson's very decisive, and he always had I think he had one of the most efficient of any Broncos back last season as far as per carry yardage.
Yeah.
I think he ran five.
He was actually, in terms of yardage per touch, which incorporates receptions, he was second among running backs, and he was first in touchdown rate. Obviously, a smaller sample size, but he scored I believe it was once every 19.3 times he touched the football.
Yeah.
And he, you know, we saw he could be effective in short yardage, but I think to call him simply a short yardage runner is selling him short. I think he's got use all around the field in all situations.
Well, I mean,
but the short yardage thing does help because it does give him a unique skill set among the group. And
yeah,
you know, when you're figuring out who are the three or four running backs that you're going to keep on the 53-man roster, with each of them, you're asking, okay, what do you bring that's unique? And that's why I think Juwan Thompson, when all is said and done, will be on the 53.
I know it's short sample size for just one run, but it seems almost counterintuitive to try and limit Juwan Thompson as a short yardage guy when he had the longest run.
Yeah, Exactly. And the play I'll never forget from him, it was actually in the preseason in San Francisco when he gets a pass in the flat from Brock Osweiler and he just makes a guy miss. And it's like, who you're thinking, you're watching it and going, wow, this 225, 230-pound guy, he's in the open field, and he's stopping on a dime and letting the defender fly by him and then going and then quickly accelerating and getting toward the end zone. That, I mean, that's the thing with Juwan Thompson that I like about him. He's full of surprises.
Yeah.
You look at him and say, oh, he can't do that, but he does. And that's and so I think if anyone sleeps on him and his prospects, I think they're making a mistake because I think that he's going to end up helping this team this year.
Well, they're definitely going to have some interesting picks to choose from. They're going to probably use a lot of backs. I was talking to CJ, this is a couple of weeks ago, about how important it was that they've had Coach Studisville back there throughout the coaching change. And for years, he's been there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been there before, like any of these backs were you know, drafted or signed here. Very loyal part of the Broncos. Mm-hmm. And his retention, I guess I would say, has been really important. As CJ Anderson said, they all have this a very close relationship, and you can see it when they do running back drills.
Mm-hmm.
With Eric kind of trying to punch the ball out with the pads, and they're all smiling during that. And they said that not having to learn like a new coach, not having to get to know a new coach, not having to prove themselves to a new coach, and vice versa, having to trust a new person, has been really important for them. Mm-hmm. As they move into this new scheme completely.
Says a lot that Eric Studisville has survived two head coaching changes now. Says a lot about how well he's regarded in NFL circles. And yeah, exactly. He was the interim coach for four games back in 2010. He's, you know, the Broncos have been very lucky. They've had just two running backs coaches now in the last 21 seasons. Bobby Turner was the best of his generation, and I think Eric Studisville is the best of his generation at that role. And you know, as far as getting the most out of players, but also adapting to what each system demands of its running backs and how they have to read blocks. You know, Studisville is now on his third. His third version of this offense, and actually probably the fourth version of the offense if you include what was run when Tim Tebow was at quarterback that during most of the 2011 season. And you know, he has a knack for getting the most out of those guys, and you can see how players respond to him. The other thing I like about Studisville is he's always optimistic, and he believes in every guy in that room, right down to the guy who's last on the depth chart. He sees, he looks for reasons why that player can succeed, and then encourages that player to play toward his strengths. And I think that's why Studisville is a good coach. And he hasn't gotten many nibbles for head coaching positions the last couple of years, but given how he stabilized this franchise when he was the interim head coach in 2010 and really brought a sense of dignity back to a club that really lost its way, and through all the stuff that about with the videotaping in London and some of the on-field stuff and all that, he really restored a sense of order around these parts. And that's why at some point I still think he's going to be a head coach somewhere and be a damn good one.
Yeah. The other thing that's been going around as today's July 2nd, it's not even with the NFL. It's with the NBA, and it's caught a lot of attention, especially from NFL players, however. Wednesday, free agency opened up for the NBA with expectations of the salary cap increasing exponentially. Well, maybe not exponentially, literally, but figuratively. Teams have been preparing for a huge payday,
right?
And all
these contracts are structured where a lot of the big payday, the big increases kick in not this season, but in 2016-17 when the new
rear-loaded
digital and TV contracts kick in.
Yes, and in fact, if we want to tally up the numbers, as far as new contracts and not extensions, NBA teams combined to spend $1.4 billion, billion with a B, just on new contracts. And when you add in Anthony Davis and Damian Lillard's extensions, that brings it up to 1.5 an enormous number for one day.
It is an enormous number, and seeing the tweets of some players around the NFL, I think there's a little bit of envy involved.
Oh, for sure.
Of course. There's a big difference in paying, you know, 15 players on your roster plus the guys that you have in the D League compared to paying during the season 53 on the active roster plus 10 on the practice squad plus any injured reserve. It's a little bit of a different animal involved there with, you know, fewer people splitting the pie. It's very similar to baseball as well, where, you know, now for top of the line free agents, $20 million contracts, I think this coming off season on a per annum basis are going to be the norm, you know, for just the Justin Upton's of the world.
Yeah, that's what people have been saying. It's like baseball money, pretty much, and not only that, but they're guaranteed. That's the way the CBA, the NBA's player union,
it's very similar. It's guaranteed in baseball, mostly guaranteed in the NHL.
Just ask Bobby Bonilla.
Yeah. Oh, every July 1st, he cashes a seven-figure paycheck because, as part of his deal with the Mets, they were trying to get some relief, some momentary relief in 2000. So they converted, I think it's like $1.1 million a year, something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And until 2035.
From 2013 or is it 2011 until 2035? There's a great thing that CBS Sports did a couple of years ago called the Bobblehead Project, where they did these mock-ups of bobbleheads that they would like to see, and they did one of a Bobby Bonilla in 2035. With a four-pronged cane that had little baseballs on the feet of the cane, and he's wearing kind of an old guy ensemble pants hiked up, little cap plaid shirt, and cashing his seven-figure check, and the CBSSports.com article at the time suggested this would be a great idea for an NL East team like the Braves or the Phillies, who just want to troll the Mets, to have that as a bobblehead giveaway. So when I think of Bonilla, I still think of that image. That's how indelible it was to me. But yeah,
I don't understand.
It's something to laugh about.
So Bobby Bonilla signed this, or I guess they came to this agreement with his contract. He had $6 million. What? Yeah, he had a $6 million contract, and then why did they decide to do that?
Well, part of the rationale was they really thought that the Bernie Madoff investments were going to keep paying off for them.
Mm.
So they agreed. So he was owed $5.9 million, and the Mets agreed to a buyout. Because he was struggling toward the end of that contract, and so instead of paying him $5.9 million, and I believe it was the year 2000.
Yep.
They would pay him $1.193 million for 25 years, beginning in 2011 and going through 2035. That was something they thought, okay, no problem. If we invest properly, we can do that. Of course, the interesting thing is that Bobby Bonilla this year will make twice as much as Zach Wheeler, nearly twice as much as Jacob DeGrom and Matt Harvey. All of them are in the mid-500s to the $600,000 range. In fact, I mean, let me do some quick math here. Yeah. Jacob DeGrom and Matt Harvey, they're both going to be, they both look like they're going to be all-star pitchers this year. They're a big reason why that the Mets have hung around despite, injuries to David Wright and others in their lineup. their combined salaries for this year are less than the Mets will pay Bobby Bonilla.
That's hard-earned money.
Hey, he signed the contract. He felt like he was entitled to it, but oh my goodness gracious. Oh.
Well,
the other interesting thing, like, these types of contracts, so this is getting away from the original point, but
I think we're
contracts where you're paying the guy a lot down in the future, they used to be commonplace. You know, back in the ABA in the 70s when they would, you know, when they were in a bidding war with the NBA for players, you know, they would throw out these, or they'd say, oh, we signed this player for 2.5 million over 4 years, which is for a 4 year contract.
It's like an annuity.
A lot of it was an annuity. That's how they did it. And so the players would, you know, so the player, I think one example was Joe Caldwell, played for the Carolina Cougars, and he ended up getting most of that money in like 1992, 1993, 1994, and so on. The USFL, when it competed with the NFL, did the same thing. And in fact, Steve Young, who signed with the Los Angeles Express, the USFL, on the 30 for 30 documentary on the USFL, he recalled how people in the stands right here in Denver at the old Mile High Stadium watching the Denver Gold were heckling him after he got sacked. And finally, he said, he said that his mother would turn to the person heckling him and say, "Oh, it's an annuity. It's not a it's not a real contract. He's not really getting whatever it was, $15 million or whatever the sum was at the time." But it just teams got creative, and you know, with the Mets, of course, with the Mets, it was a little bit of a different circumstance. But oh my, I mean, if you're Bobby Bonilla, I mean, that's the greatest pension plan in the world.
Yeah.
A seven-figure check every year for 25 years. I mean, sign me up for that.
You'll live off of it. I mean, I don't know how old
you
is
live,
he
you
be?
Can live great. You can live wonderfully. I mean, he's still, you know, even if Bobby Bonilla had not saved money from his playing days, he could live off that and
so
have
he's
all the money he needs to live in luxury.
He's 52 right now.
Yes.
This thing expires in 20 years. He's going to be 72 years old when he gets his last payment.
And on top of that, baseball has the best pension plan for its players. You actually go into the pension plan in MLB if you play
good
one
for him.
If you play one game. I mean, he played, gosh. He was on, they bought him out and he went to the Braves in 2000. Didn't do all that much by then, because he really didn't have anything left. Okay, 43 days if you're an MLB player to get in the pension plan. I'm sorry, 43 days to make it in, and if you hit that minimum 43 days, you can get a $34,000 a year pension.
Where's my pension?
It's one day on an active roster in MLB that gets you medical benefits for life. One day, you don't even
nice.
Have to. So you know, if you had a Moonlight Graham. Now, as career, you know, one at bat, as was said in Field of Dreams, you
maybe,
get full medical for life.
Maybe if you're one of those, you know, some guy who gets one of those one-day contracts, you know, one of those, you know, I don't know what they call them, like a kind of like just a publicity kind of thing. There you go. Now you have free health care.
Yeah, I know. So Eddie Goodell... do we call him little person, right? Because we don't want to use the other term. Who came to bat for the Bill Veeck owned St. Louis Browns and wore jersey number 18.
Yes.
And walked on four pitches because he had a microscopic strike zone. If there was an Eddie Goodell today, you know, one day. On the big club, and he'd have access to medical benefits for life.
You do a pinch runner for him, or
yes, he was immediately pulled.
And it's a small stride.
Yeah,
it's the only thing.
Well, I mean, you don't want to have to rely on the guy behind him, you know, getting a double to the gap to make sure that he can advance to third. You know, you want to get some, you know, make sure the runner can advance to third. You want to get a You don't want to get him out there. And it was actually a publicity stunt for a team that was failing. Mm. The Browns were doing so badly. They were, you know, St. Louis was struggling to support two teams at the time, the Browns and the Cardinals. They were, you know, Vec was trying to do anything to get attendance up. And actually, it was sort of touch and go which St. Louis franchise would stay until the Bush family bought the Cardinals. At that, and then the writing was on the wall, and the Browns moved to Baltimore, where they became the Orioles. That's your bit of old school baseball trivia for this Independence Day weekend. And happy Independence Day, by the way. You know, it's this weekend, of course, is the anniversary of when President Whitmore led a ragtag band of pilots to go take out the alien invaders in 1996.
A moment that will go down in infamy.
In history, I guess.
Yes. We have gone so far away from the original point.
Well, the original point, I mean, I think to illustrate just the difference, it's just illustrating the differences in the sports. Now, given that I think players have always been pretty educated about contracts and other sports, you know, they're always monitoring what is going on in the other leagues. But I think when this CBA expires, I do wonder if the fight's going to be over guaranteed money and eventually trying to get those contracts guaranteed. And the other interesting thing with guarantees in the league of the NFL, of course, is what money is guaranteed has to be put in escrow. Mm. So, you know, hypothetically speaking, let's say the Broncos give Demaryius Thomas a big guarantee. If they manage to get him re-signed this month, as they're attempting and hoping to do, they've got to take whatever the guarantee part of it is. They've got to take it, and they've got to put that money aside.
Yeah,
and it's you understand why they do that, because then it's in part to protect the player, but in part it's designed to make sure that every team is operating, with financial restraint and operating within its limits. Because you know, if you didn't have that money in escrow, and let's say you were a team that had some financial issues, and all of a sudden you had this guarantee due, and you didn't necessarily have the cash flow, it would be an amazing black eye and embarrassment for the league. That's why.
Yes.
That's why that clause exists.
Now, like, fairness and guaranteedness aside, I think that's a huge reason the NFL has so much parity, and the NBA is moving in that direction, still not quite there yet, as evidenced by like the 76ers and their process that, they're going
through. Trust the process.
Trust the process. But, if partial guaranteed contracts were more predominant in the NBA, they do have non-guaranteed contracts for some players. Mm-hmm. It would, make rectifying some wrongs like amnesties a lot more a lot more even, make the league a lot more even, but that comes at a pretty big price.
Yeah,
but only for the players.
Yeah, and the other thing that hurts that really is something the NBA has to work on as far as competitive balance. Obviously, it's still a star-driven league. As I was telling Phil Milani this morning, even the Hawks roster in the conference finals, as injury-riddled as it was at that point, was still probably better 1-10 than the Cavaliers roster. But
yes,
the Cavs had the best player and arguably the second best player on the court at the time because Kyrie Irving was healthy. And thus it was a sweep. The Hawks are trying to do something that really hasn't been done but one time in the last 35 years. Win a championship without a star. You can really only point to the 04 Detroit Pistons.
Yeah. That team,
but
I guess they
don't
really
said,
have a
Chauncey
star.
Billups
but Rasheed
played,
Wallace,
Rasheed
Chauncey
Wallace played
Billups.
Well, and Chauncey Billups was at his apex.
Yeah.
Big time Broncos fan. It's good to give him a shout out on here. So you could argue they got star performance from him, and of course, Rasheed Wallace, who
I think famously
had a urinal in his house, as was profiled on Cribs. Back in the day, that made him one of my personal heroes.
I think had that 2004 team come a decade later, we wouldn't be talking about them not having a star team, because the advancement of analytics mm-hmm. would have really probably driven up the value, and not value like financially or basketball.
People understanding what a because you have PER and you can actually understand what a player brings beyond just the basic stats.
And the other major difference is people will look back at that team and they'll see how few points they scored per game, mm-hmm. how few assists they got per game, and if you adjust those for pace, then they're probably going to look a lot better. Mm-hmm. I can't say I've looked this up, but the pace is definitely something that makes them look like they're not as good as they were. And though they didn't have one star player, because I definitely see that when you talk about a star player being someone who can just take control of a game, like LeBron James or Kobe.
I mean, they're definitely an exception to the rule. And I mean, the reason I kind of said 35 years is, I looked back at this. I was looking at the '79 Sonics, who had a lot of good to very good players at the time: Jack Sigma, Dennis Johnson, et cetera. But kind of lacked that one central, downtown Freddie Brown. Can't forget him.
Is that the team that lost the Bullets?
They lost the Bullets in 78, and they won it in 79.
Oh, they won in 79. Okay.
Yeah, they came back and won it in 79. But then 1980, the Lakers won it, and that was the Lakers team of the first Magic-Kareem tandem team. 81 Celtics, Bird. 82 Lakers, Magic, Kareem. 83 Sixers, Dr. J and Moses. They all had at least one star, and on and on and on and on and on. That was kind of the demarcation point. This is the NBA being star driven as far as winning a championship. It's not a recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
And hey, if you can't get that star, credit to trying to figure out another way. Frankly, I hope the Hawks do succeed at some point in the next few years, even though I have trouble believing.
I think Al Horford is
borderline.
Close. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I mean, if the Hawks can do it, it's going to give a lot of teams hope in the NBA. Baseball's a little different animal than basketball because it's not as star driven. You can be a team like the Kansas City Royals last year and have some good players, and yet
they're all stars.
That's something I'm gonna cringe if that doesn't change between now and Sunday. I'm going to cringe when I see Omar Infante, nice enough guy, decent utility infielder, should never be within the same area code of an All-Star game. I'm sorry. And actually, this wouldn't be his first All-Star appearance, but he was a manager selection, I believe, in 2010. Yeah, 2010, he was a manager selection by Charlie Manuel when Infante was playing for the Atlanta Braves. But yeah, oy. But the thing is, to get away from the voting, the Royals, they had big game. James Shields had some great starts last year, but it was not a star-driven team. I think a key for the Royals was the fact they didn't have any guys who were dragging down their lineup.
Yeah.
You didn't, there weren't, it wasn't a team that had an excess, that had many guys that were negative in wins above replacement. It was a lot of guys who were competent to good, no anchors in the lineup, and it,
if you're as strong as your weakest link, then
yeah, and certainly, and that's something that that helps in baseball, and it also ensures that if you make a massive mistake on a contract, if you can just find those guys who are competent and don't bring down the lineup, you can overcome that and not necessarily fall off the cliff. Whereas in the NBA, if you had let's take the Milwaukee Bucks, for instance, and if Monroe can't play up to that contract, that's going to cripple them, especially in a few years when I'm sure they're going to want to re-sign Jabari Parker.
Yeah, it is interesting that you mentioned Monroe, because we were talking about the shift in parity and all that. Both the Lakers and I think the Knicks offered him max contracts, and he picked the Bucks over both of those teams.
He probably sees them as closer.
Oh, for sure.
I don't blame him.
It's hard to refute that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Bucks, you've got You know, Jabari Parker looked like, you know, certainly before he had the ACL, we'll see what he's like coming back, but he looked like he could be that guy that carries a franchise. And some good, good complimentary parts around him. Giannis. And Antetokounmpo, the Greek freak. You know, it's
OJ Mayo.
It looks like the team that, you know, if you're Monroe, you're sitting there, okay, which team is closest to winning, to contending for a championship? If you're comparing with the Lakers, obviously the Lakers are in the West and Bucks are in the East, so that alone would kind of tilt it toward the Bucks. And then you look at the Knicks, and it's dysfunctional, and they tore down, but they've still got the Carmelo contract. They look like they're in a state of stasis from which they're not going to emerge for a good while. Milwaukee, even without Parker, snuck into the playoffs this year. The East is more wide open.
They're adding a lot of pieces with that team.
And the other thing that contract tells me is that, obviously now it's in the hands of the Wisconsin Politicos, but it tells me that they think they're about to push this new arena right over the goal line and get it and get it done. I don't think you'd see the Bucks making that kind of commitment without knowing that, hey, this thing's going to get done. We're going to get that new building, and we're going to say basketball for Milwaukee.
The only thing I didn't like about the Bucks is when they traded for Carter Williams.
Yeah.
I thought they were better off with, was it Brandon Knight, I think?
Yeah.
Carter Williams, he's not a great shooter. Brandon Knight, above average, well above average.
It didn't look like the best chemistry move either. I'm not exactly on the order of the trade the Pacers made a year back, but
I didn't think it would
help them. But then you look at how they end up doing it. It didn't really hurt them. It didn't really hurt them. You can argue that whether it helped them or not, but it didn't hurt them. I don't think it made a difference whether Milwaukee, got to the playoffs or not, or went six games or not.
I realize that, NBA trade deadline, you're not just looking for someone to help right now, but down the line. However, I cannot remember the last time a team has made, a win-now move, like a team that's looking to buy, made a move at the deadline, and then just seamlessly incorporate them into the team and went on and ran through the playoffs and went beyond the first round.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I know that because the Bobcats did that for many years.
I think part of it is the nature of the sport. You know, basketball. It's ironic that we talk about it being star driven, but on a majority of possessions, everyone touches the ball. Mm-hmm. It is a collaborative sport. It's not as easy as plugging one guy in. You know, baseball is an individual sport. It's one on one matchups, pitcher versus batter. That's why you can, find that difference maker at the trade deadline in July, or even at the waiver deadline in late August, that you can find those guys and you can push yourself over the top. In the NBA, I don't think it's possible. What's interesting is that every year somebody tries.
Yep.
Still,
the one that stands out to me is Tyrus Thomas, because the Bobcats ended up trading a first round pick for Tyrus Thomas. Mm-hmm. And he was an expiring contract, and he did well. He did well when they were pushing for that playoff bid, mm-hmm. but then they had to go and pay him like $40 million over 4 or 5 years. They ended up amnestying him. Mm-hmm. He had some tough injury problems, but that was, you give up a first round pick, and they eventually came back from that, but having to do some trading magic with the Pistons, who had dug themselves into big holes. So you just never find that person who you think is going to push you over the edge if you're an 8, 7, 6 seed, mm-hmm. especially in the East when you're facing like one or two dominant seeds in the East. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. You might as well just wait. Just wait for the free agency.
You might as well, but the problem is teams, that because they sense other teams are going to wait for free agency, they see that window. You know, the Bobcats.
You want to get something for them
exactly,
while you can.
Yeah, and
you're going to let them go.
And the Bobcats / Hornets over the years, you can kind of understand their desperation. You know, two postseason appearances now in 11 seasons since mm-hmm. returning,
right.
And no wins.
Yeah. Zero postseason
wins.
Wins.
I mean,
Two sweeps.
Yeah, you can see why a club in that situation would be desperate. You don't see it.
Desperation.
You don't see as obviously. You don't see many moves like that in the NFL. But I mean, well, a good. Let's give a potential example. The trading deadline has been moved back in the NFL. The last few years, in part because the NFL actually wants to see teams making some deadline deals. Because I think they look at the excitement in baseball at trade deadline and in the buzz that goes on, and think, okay, we want a little piece of that. What MLB has in late July?
NBA.
Yeah. How do we get in on NHL? Has a great trade deadline.
Every league except the NFL has an exciting trade deadline.
So, of course. Let's say you're Cleveland and Broncos. Okay, let's do a hypothetical that Broncos fans don't want to hear. The Browns upset the Broncos in October. They get to they're 5-3.
The Browns are?
Yeah.
Okay.
At midseason, they're hanging around. You know, that's the kind of team that the NFL wants to see make a deadline deal, you know, to kind of to see if they can't, you know, that being absent from the playoffs since making it in 2002, you know, that maybe they bite trying to push themselves over the top. We'll see. Yeah, and I just said the Broncos might lose to the Browns. I will go immolate myself now.
Well, I definitely would enjoy the trade deadline from a fan perspective, but it's always one of the worst days when I was covering the NBA mm-hmm. trade deadline or the free agency, like, first day. Just really harried. Really,
well, it's not the first day of free agency. It's the first night because it kicks in at 12:01 a.m. Eastern time. That's actually another, as a fan, I kind of love the fact that everything just goes loony at midnight.
Yes.
Eastern. Now,
and I also love it on the flip side,
right,
on trade deadline when it's the end is at like one or three or something mm-hmm. like Eastern, but like because they have to fax in stuff or something, that there's always stuff that's going to come
talk
out
about
like
faxes
five
around here, man.
There's always going to be like trades that come out like 5 minutes after or 10 minutes after because they have to go through.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Oh, it's
why
it's
they're, you know, faxes.
Thrilling.
Oh my, but. Work. I'll say this: if the NFL ever went to a situation where the league year started at 12:01 a.m., okay, I wouldn't like that at all. I like it as a spectator, but
I'd fall asleep.
I'd rather have it to where it's, you know,
it was so much
middle
easier
of the afternoon.
It was so much easier for me to stay up for NBA free agency starts when I was in college or fresh out of college, and I could just be like, well,
sure,
yeah. It's not so easy now that I have, like, a full-time job.
Job, responsibilities, hours to keep, all that, yeah. You find it's not as easy to just be on call, you know, whenever, but so it goes. But I don't think the NFL, actually, I'll say this, the start of their free agency, I would say, is probably as good as the NBA's is.
It's pretty
the NFL
good.
Is pretty hard to beat in the middle of the afternoon. And how active it is. Now, I personally don't like that window, that kind of soft window when teams can talk to players but not make deals and all that they had this past year.
It seems weird.
Didn't like it at all, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
But it probably will end up staying because it added four more days of conversation and buzz and, you know, put the NFL in the spotlight. And you know, league loves that.
Yeah. Why wouldn't
the league loves the fact that it's virtually an all-year enterprise, except, frankly, right now, although we're here keeping the fire burning for you. It's, you know, the countdown to camp is on. It's, you know, coaches are on vacation. Players are scattered. Not all of them.
I think more
players
are going to leave soon.
Yeah. They had just enough of them in town to where they had four players over at Children's Hospital in Aurora on Wednesday, and that was cool. But, yeah, guys are scattering.
Vacation time.
Or in the case, if you're Corey Nelson, you go on a mission.
Yeah, that's pretty
cool. Going to Haiti, as he told me on Wednesday, you know, even though we're, you know, 5.5 years removed from the devastating earthquake, there's still a need for relief. There's still a need for rebuilding, and he is going down there for the second straight year to help to provide a hand. You know, just everything from, you know, just
that's why he's the
lifting stuff and all that.
That's why he is the Broncos Community Rookie of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's impressive.
And hey, if he say he's going to be moving stuff, helping construction, lifting stuff, carrying stuff, that's a workout. He doesn't need the weight room. He just go, you know, he can kill two birds with one stone. He can get his workout in, but then most importantly, actually provide some help for people who need it. So
that's good. Well, that'll wrap up our podcast. Ooh, a really long one today. We're at 50 minutes right now.
Well, take us with you if you've taken us to your workout over the weekend. If you're trying to work off that barbecue meal you have on Independence Day, thanks for joining us.
Or if you're just stuck in traffic on your way down the mountains. But thanks for joining us, as Mace just said. Subscribe on iTunes is always an option, and we'll catch you all next week.